Lectionary Lab Live is recorded by Two Bubbas and a Bible live from Gainesville, Florida and Brasstown, North Carolina. Welcome, everybody, to the Lectionary Lab Live. I'm John Fairless, and I'm here with my Bubba, Delmer Chilton. Say hey, Bubba.
Hey, Bubba.
Hey, man, good to hear you today. Good to hear from you and to be with you, all of you, friends and neighbors, fellow preachers, pastors, and proclaimers. We're glad to get together for another section to talk a little text, think about preaching. These are texts for the third Sunday in Lent. March the 4th, 2018. We're moving right along, Bubba. And today we've got a gospel passage. We step over into John for a little bit. And one of those, I don't know if it's a tricky passage or not. It's not always comfortable for us to deal with this passage for today. But we'll come back and we've got the Decalogue today. We've been talking about that series of covenants that we've had in our Hebrew scripture readings. And wow, the heart of Paul's message from 1 Corinthians. So good stuff today. Tell me what you're thinking. What direction do we want to go here for this third Sunday in Lent?
Well, one of the things I was thinking about is that just some buzz on various places in social media among some people, not a big buzz, but just some questions about the way the gospel lessons in the season of Lent from year B, kind of, as someone put it, kind of head jerk. You know, You go from one thing to the other, and you go from the boot.
You're over here and then you're over there.
John,
yeah.
You're over here and there in this long, the story of Jesus' life. And, right. And John, this text, well, part of that, we jump out of Mark into John, and the very story itself is in Matthew, Mark, and Luke is in Holy Week at the end of their gospels. And in John, it's at the beginning. And so One of the things I wanted to say, as you think about this, is remember that at least this year in particular, Lent is more designed more thematically than chronologically.
Right.
So it's very important to look at the overall and say, oh, here's where we're moving. And it's more of an emotional movement than it is a chronological movement in these gospel lessons. And it's moving from, you know, the temptations and then the taking up the cross. And today it's about, where that's going to lead Jesus again, you know, this issue of being the death and resurrection for this Lent. It really focuses on those 3 days, and we're moving toward the 3 days. And that's where the part to focus on 2:19, you can destroy this temple and I can rebuild it in 3 days. And that John's kind of, this is where I'm going with John. It's always the him saying, Jesus saying one thing and people hearing another. It goes back and forth, like the woman at the well and living water, and you don't have a bucket. You know, he's talking about spirituality. She's talking about water. Well, here, when Jesus says in 2:19, destroy this temple, he's talking about himself as the presence of the glory of God in the world. And they think he's still talking about destruction of the physical temple. So you got to be aware of that kind of dynamic that's going on when you're telling this story. So that's kind of where I am with playing around.
Yeah. Well, I think it's good to remember. And, you know, the Bible as a whole, or as we have it, the texts that we work with that we call the Bible, if we're not careful, we can lull ourselves into thinking the whole thing is written chronologically, that it all fits, that, you know, you just read this and one thing leads to another. But that's not necessarily true either. And so these gospel readings, really, they're kind of plugged into the way we have this word, this written word, preserved. And that's part of the challenge, I think, for us to deal with it. For me, it's a good reminder. Don't ever fall into the trap of thinking you've got it all figured out, Pastor. preacher. Well, you know what's in this text. You know everything there is to know. And that's part of the challenge of a season like Lent. We come through these texts year after year. Some of our people have heard them often, and they're walking in thinking, I don't have anything new to learn here. Well, yeah. We all do.
Well, you know, I've been playing around with, as many people are, with Ancestry.com and looking at things. And what I've continually discover is I'll find out something, and then what happens is I say, ah, now that makes sense. So there's something from my childhood that I've known about, and now at my mid-60s, I look back and I find out something I never heard about, and I plug that into the story and things. And that's how we understand life. We don't get it narratively. We don't understand it in a chronological order. We get it as we begin to have insight. So I think for the preacher today is to come to this story and find a way to bring insights.
Right.
And that's what I hope to do as we move forward with talking about John a little bit.
All right, let's do it, man.
All right. So one of the things is to always understand when you're reading John, that when John mentions the Passover, it's a signal this story is about death, life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. Mm-hmm. That's just a Johannine thing. So whenever a story says when the Passover was near, you got to perk up your ears and say, where is this going to relate to the death and resurrection of Jesus? So that's an important thing. So as we look at this, the second thing I want to talk about is when you think about the temple, very important thing for John is hearkening back all the way to the days in the wilderness, which Exodus sort of reflects for us with the story here of the giving of the Ten Commandments. Think about in Exodus and the tabernacle, the tent, and what is that about? It is about a place where the presence of the glory of God is in the world.
Right.
It's where God dwells with humanity. That's the nature of the temple. It is God's residence with us, a sign to us humans that we can know God is with us. I just want to say homiletically how important that for people that is to have some sense that in this world, God is present with them. That's what the temple represented. Now, the other piece is, and you say in the temple, he found people selling cattle and doves and money changers and all of that. This is not a new problem in Israel. Go back to Zechariah, you know, in that day, the coming day of the Lord, there will not be traitors in the temple. This has been a long-standing prophetic problem, you know, and at various times, the people who sell the necessary stuff, the animals, and they change the money so they can pay the temple tax. This is necessary business, but it was in the Kidron Valley and the Mount of Olives, and it crept closer and closer. Mm-hmm. And Jesus' complaint is, it's moved inside the temple.
Yeah.
He doesn't say it's not necessary that people be able to buy these things. It's a necessity. But they have pushed aside. They have let the secular, commercial, material necessities push the glory of the God out of the presence. So you can't walk in there and be aware that the glory of God is there.
Yeah.
That's what he's getting at. So when you get to that point, I'm going to do an aside in a moment about driving animals, but I want to stay with this. So he does this, and they say, well, what authority are you doing that? He has messed up the system, but most people have come to say, this is just the way it is.
Hmm.
You know, this is just the way it is. We can't do anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
And everything's running smoothly. Everybody's getting their portion. And it had gotten to the point where something that previous generations had thought was not okay had become a norm for them about this buying and selling. And he drives all this out. Then John takes it and makes a shift because they're saying, by what sign can you show us for doing this? This is important. You know, John's about the signs.
Signs.
And this is where the shift takes place from the physical temple. Because they didn't say, Jesus is the one who said, destroy this temple. And they think he's talking about the environment they're standing in. And John is saying, destroy the Christ and, you know, this temple, Jesus, and I'll rebuild it. Of course, they go back to the dialogue. It's been under construction for 46 years. Then John makes it clear he was speaking of the temple of his body. And so the homiletic piece is twofold. One is the kind of pragmatic piece for me about how do you make this really real for your parishioners. It's not about a bunch of people 2,000 years ago arguing over a temple system we don't care about anymore.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And so one of the questions homiletically is to begin to deal with in what ways have we allowed the glory of God to be pushed out of our religious life? How have we allowed ourselves to begin to focus too much on what last week's lesson Jesus said to Peter, human things and not things above.
Right.
And that's a question we should ask ourselves about each local context. I can't answer that for everybody. Right. I think that's really a pretty much a local context question. But individually, you know, how have we let things that aren't really about the glory of God shining in the world taken over our community of faith?
In what ways have we allowed the outside world or the natural world, and maybe even functions that are perfectly normal and even healthy, needed, whatever, in what ways have we allowed those to encroach in this holy space? The roots of the tabernacle, there was no doubt that when you stepped across that and came through that very first entrance, it was literally designed to be the narrow way. That was just a certain, and when you crossed that, you were on holy ground. You did not bring the things of the world with you. Immediately as you came in, there were places for cleansing, and you met the priest and so on and so forth. And for me, I want to say to myself and to all of us, what happens when I walk through that door back there?
Right.
You know, when I enter this space, when I was growing up, the big rule was for kids, no running in the church. That meant inside the sanctuary.
You know?
And I've heard people over the years, oh, they're just kids being kids. And I kind of reflect on that now. And I don't want to be mean to the kids any more than Jesus was trying to be mean to the sheep and the cattle. But there are some things that don't belong in here. There's a sense of it's different when I walk through that door.
Right.
I'm entering the presence of the holy, and I think we have, at minimum, a challenge with coming so comfortable with holy things that we lose a sense of that holiness, that awe, and maybe this Lenten text is a good time to stir that up a little bit and confront that a little bit.
And there's no need to get in a big argument about ultimate what things belong in the worship space and what don't and all of that. But there is an awareness of turning space into sacred space. And how does that happen? I think that's what you may mean to talk about in
your
community. How does that happen? Because every sacred space is different. I have pastored congregations that met in anything from tremendous modern facility to John, when you and I was meeting in your fellowship hall, and it was a place where, you know, my kids included played basketball.
It was a gym,
and my boys would I needed to set up chairs on Saturday, mission developer, you know.
Yeah.
We'd go over and set up chairs on Saturday night, and I bribed my teenage boys by playing an hour of basketball with them before we did it. But we transitioned that from a space in which we just played ball that for that time on Sunday morning was a holy space.
Yeah.
And it wasn't, and it's what happens there. And this is Jesus' point.
Yeah.
And so I don't know how you imagine that for your community, but what he was basically saying is not a particular activity that people needed to buy the right animals for sacrifice and changed right. their money, et cetera. It's where it was happening. And that, so just the aside on that piece, while we're still kind of in what Jesus did, is that I've all too often heard this as an excuse when somebody loses their temper. This is right. kind of an aside. This is more of a Sunday school moment. Well, even Jesus got angry and drove the money changers out of the temple. I just want to observe that at least in John, it clearly says he drove all of them out of the temple, comma, both the sheep and the cattle. Never says he took he never says he flogged anybody.
Kicked a table or two over.
Kicked but, a table or you two know, over yeah. and that sort of thing. But he didn't hit anybody. My nonviolent pacifist is coming out. But just be careful.
Yeah.
Careful with the use of that. And know
well, and you gave us a tie to this earlier in the first Sunday in Lent. We have the term here, driving right. them out of the temple. It's the same term used when the Spirit drove Jesus into the wilderness.
Right.
It's a very active term. We don't necessarily have to call it violent, except that it is sudden and it is forceful. And so there is something happening here.
Well,
and I would say at a minimum, this language should make us jerk our heads a little bit.
It forced people in a direction they didn't want to go on their own. That's what it is. I think of it in terms of when I was my ordained in 1977, Bishop Joe Thomas of Ohio, Cleveland area, preached this sermon down in North Carolina at this big ordination for about 20 of us. And he said, the Holy Spirit will lead you somewhere you don't want to go. And he said, really, it will drive you somewhere you don't want to go. Because if you wanted to go there, the Holy Spirit would be unnecessary.
Yeah.
And that's the nature of drove. It will push us and make sure we go there. Daddy used to send me out to drive the cows up. Mm-hmm. I never touched them, but I made sure they went where they weren't necessarily wanting to go.
Yeah.
That's the nature of drive. So anyway, moving on. The other thing in John is, of course, the whole sign destroy and the connection with the death and resurrection looking forward. And part of what the focus here is that when Jesus transitions this to be about him, this is part of John's showing to the world. John's gospel is showing this is the light of the world come into the world. The Word was God, and the Word was with God, and the Word came and dwelt among us. Jesus is throughout John's gospel. It's about Jesus being the presence of God in the world. I don't want to supersede the temple kind of thing, but it is when he says, I am the temple, he's saying the temple was a sign of God's presence with us. And for Christians, Jesus' life, death, and resurrection is a sign of God's presence with us.
That's exactly it. John is the sign's gospel. And so we have a sign here. Jesus is answering the question. It's just not the question they were asking. What sign can you show us? Destroy this temple. And John is the one who's pointing back. And we know the church is reading this back and say, oh, see, he did give them a sign. It was the sign of his body, the temple. And so the deeper meaning functions here.
Well, and the last piece for John, for me on John, is this twice of the use remembered. Once when the disciples remembered that it was written, zeal for your house will consume me. And then later, particularly when he talks about, you know, destroy this and I'll raise it in 3 days. And after his resurrection, they remembered. And so it's for me, it's one of those things of the whole thematic and not chronological. The disciples experience this. Subsequent events, they remembered what had happened and put two and two together. This is what we do. It's theological remembrance. We see a thing, we live through a thing, and then in reflection, we remember new things happen, and we begin to have the aha moments that we begin to have. And this is what we do when we think about the life of Jesus and our life, we begin to put the two together and we remember. I grew up in rural Baptist church with the communion table that in do this. John, help me remember. Some of them just said in remembrance. Yeah. It was all, and some a little bit more. And so that was out there. And then, and then week after week, all these years as a weekly Eucharist person, you know, I've said it over and over again, do this in remembrance of me, or when you do this, remember me, and remembering, and thus the English of it, is interesting. Your arms and legs are the members of your body.
Right.
To be remembered is you were disconnected and you're put back together.
Remember. Yeah.
Remember. And so when you remember, you put things back together. Yeah. And I think that's a, maybe an interesting theme for today is theological or spiritual remembrance, starting at the beginning, end of this text, and thinking about where they were, the disciples, when they saw the resurrection and they began to remember what came before. And we in Lent, you know, we can't pretend we're not on the other side of the cross.
Right.
Okay. So what we're about is remembering what led to the cross and what the resurrection means for us.
That's it.
As we look at these stories.
In a very powerful way, that memory comes to us. It is fulfilled again in us. And also a sense that we are there. We are taken back to that. There's both aspects of remembering as it's used here. And it's made fresh. It's made new again. It is, as you say, remembered. The members are brought back together. We're connected to these disciples, to this Jesus standing and saying, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. And that's incredulous to those who are listening, which will connect us to some of the other texts for today, but yeah.
Well, let me say just a brief word about the lesson from Exodus. Mm-hmm. And then I know you want to say a few things about Corinthians,
absolutely.
Well, I could talk all day and preach for weeks, which I have on Exodus 21 through 17, and taught it for many times. It's a huge part, large part of Luther's small catechism, which we teach to confirmands. So, I don't want to go into any of that. I want to emphasize the first couple of lines. Mm-hmm. Then God spoke all these words, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. Mm-hmm. I want to point out that so often we make relationship to God as an if-then proposition. Mm-hmm. Particularly, we try to do this with the Hebrew Scriptures. We try to say, well, in the Old Testament or the Hebrew Scriptures, God said, if you do this, then I'll love you. If you do this. And so we turn the Ten Commandments into if-then, mm-hmm. if you do this, then you'll be okay. How many times have you had someone, you talk to somebody about the gospel, and they'll say to you, well, I don't know. I pretty much live by the Ten Commandments. Mm-hmm. And the response I want to make is, no, you don't. Nobody does. Purely, not the way Jesus.
It's that pretty much that gets you there, brother.
Yeah. Now, I try to go by the Ten Commandments. And then I said, but secondly, that's not the point of the Ten Commandments. And this makes it very clearly, God acted first.
Yeah.
They had done nothing to be saved, brought out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. And it's only if we interpret salvation very narrowly as, you know, a conversion experience to accepting Christ and try to apply that, that doesn't work. But if you take the larger picture of God's salvific action for the world, God acts first and asks us to respond. And the Ten Commandments are is the stipulation of the covenant. When we talk about the five covenants of Lent, this one is God has acted first in rescuing God's people and bringing them out. It's a, because I saved you, therefore, this is how you will behave. This is how you will live. Yeah. This is how you will be. Actually, some people would say that particularly the second part of this is a statement of liberation, because slaves have to do what their master says. Yeah. And he says, because I have rescued you, you shall not murder, because you no longer will be a, if the master says kill this person, you have to do it. Mm-hmm. Because I have rescued you from slavery, you shall not commit adultery. No longer will you mm-hmm. be breeding stock for the master. You know, that's a liberating statement. You shall not steal. You are a free person.
Yeah.
I have rescued you and your life, but it happened. It's not because you did all these things, then I saved you. It's I saved you. Now you're free to do right. these things.
Right. That understanding really strengthens later, for example, Paul's teaching. Why do you want to turn and go back into slavery?
Yes.
Why should you go back into slavery to sin and be entangled by these things? That's rooted in this understanding of this covenant that God has made. And it's a covenant that God has initiated.
Yes.
And I think that's the strength of pointing right. this out, particularly right. if you're following along with these readings as one of the One of the tracks you've suggested is to use these covenants that we're reading each week.
Torah is not the problem. Mm-hmm. It's thinking that living by Torah is precursor to God loving us.
Right.
And in actuality, living by Torah, as Paul puts out, you're not a slave to it. You're set free by it.
Yeah.
And we keep turning it a gift into a duty.
Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah, that's it. Psalm 19, what else can you say? One of the great praise yes. songs in the Hebrew scripture. There just are no words. There just aren't any words. To be able to describe God, and then the psalm takes that and says, that's true. There's no speech. There's no words. There's no place. The voice of the heavens is not heard. The glory of God is neither limited nor defined completely by our words. We try. We are to speak our praise and to sing our praise. But just know, folks, the world, the universe, the cosmos, all that is declaring the glory of God. That's what makes it so powerful then to come down to that last verse, the prayer that I know you and many others yeah. use each week. So since all this other stuff is going on, let the words of my mouth and yeah. the meditation of my heart be acceptable. I want to join creation. What a great thing.
If you ever get tempted to just use law all the time,
yeah.
and in kind of a Western legal sense, this psalm is full of other ways to say that. It opens up a lot of the nuances of yeah. what Torah was about. You've got law, testimony, precepts, commandment, ordinances, and it's the Torah is perfect, sure, right,
yeah.
pure, clear, clean, true, righteous. I mean, it's yeah. just it's multifaceted when we're dealing with that. And then you get to that point of saying, because of all this, I want to serve you, Lord.
That's it. That's absolutely it. Don't know if anybody's going to want to tackle Corinthians this week. Maybe you've been following along in the epistle readings. I was certainly struck when I said earlier in the show that we get sort of the heart of Paul's message here. That evocative phrase that begins with verse 18, the message about the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, and yet it is wisdom to those of us who have seen it. Playing around with this idea of foolishness, that this is a foolish message proclaimed by fools. That's part of what we are called to. And in harmony with John, Paul comes later and he says, this foolishness of God, this cross, this is the sign, okay? This is the wisdom. The world's looking for these things. This is God's answer. This is the wisdom of God. This is the power of God. And yet, that word for foolishness is the root word for moron.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, moros. And, you know, which of us wants to be seen as a moron? Okay, which one of us wants to be seen as a fool? And it can be a hindrance. What would I do with this text? I'm going to go back to our standard, and I'm going to ask our questions. Okay, what's the problem here? All right. Well, you know, it just didn't then, and it doesn't now sometimes seem to be very wise to be a Christ follower. People are going to think I'm a moron. I mean, after all, dying in order to live, giving up power in order to find the power of God. Well, you know, what's the solution here? Well, there's a deeper power at work. We're talking about God's foolishness being wiser than the wisdom of the world, God's weakness being stronger than any country's nuclear arsenal or strengthened border security or intelligence service or anything else. Why does that matter? Ah, it's Lent. We are living the same temptation as Christ, to trust a way other than God's way. And so we're going to have to confront that. And I think this is an excellent text for doing that. How do we help people see what ways are being offered to us that either are or are not God's way in this world?
There are a couple of things there that, tapping back into the culture of the first century, there was a great trust and belief in the sacrifice of one heroic person for the benefit of the community. The good man dying for the city, for whatever, standing at the, and so that was there. And coupled with it was the extreme and total humiliation of dying on a cross. To even say something about crucifixion was vulgar in that culture. Right. So what we don't understand is we have turned the death of Jesus on the cross from what it was, you know, a vulgar crucifixion execution by the state, into a heroic person standing in the way and dying in order to save everybody. We would prefer that. And this is part of the struggle we have. We try to turn God's foolishness into something that matches our wisdom.
Into a way of seeming wise,
You know, about the brave Jesus going to the cross and suffering, you know, the death for all of us. We try to turn it, and there's that element of it, but be very careful. This text reminds us not to tie into that righteous man, brave person, you know, going down with the ship so the rest of us can live. That's not what happened. It's part of what happened.
This is not simply the myth of Odysseus magnified.
And that's what we try to do in multiple ways. And we need to stay with the foolishness of God.
The foolishness. Cannot leave the foolishness. Don't be a moron, people. Or wait, maybe you do be a moron. Let us not leave the foolishness of God's wisdom. Well, Bubba, we want to take one extra minute, if y'all will bear with us. We want to give you an update on our upcoming Lectionary Lab workshop. We're calling it something, but we're kind of talking about making it a next level experience in which we will gather in the mountains of Western North Carolina at the Hinton Center. And we are going to both include the standard features of our normal Lectionary Lab workshop, but we're going to take it a little further, and we're going to offer some next level opportunity, particularly for those who have joined us before. Tell us, Bubba, real quick, your perspective on that. Give us the dates, and we're going to have to kind of leave it as more information coming, but we do want to invite people to reserve some time.
Take your calendar out and mark Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, April 30th through May the 2nd, Hinton Rural Life Center in Hayesville, North Carolina. That's just in about 2 hours north of Atlanta and a couple hours south of Knoxville, and you know, in that little tip, we're out there. Great place. And what we're going to do is we're going to do our base lectionary and how we do that, and things to think about and how to come to working with a homily and some basic stuff we do. In the past, we've done for the text for Lent or for Advent. What we're going to do is basically look at summer portion of ordinary time.
Right. Preaching for the summer.
Preaching for the summer. And one of the things we're going to talk about is ways to use the lectionary for to build on one another and the extended kind of thing. Partially that helps with cuts down on preparation time in some ways, but using the alternate text and working from one Hebrew scripture text through the summer and working with that story or something along those lines, or building off of a theme, having a theme and using the text and working together. Just some very options for building, well, I guess what in John's tradition is sometimes called a preaching series.
Yeah. Will I be able to build a sermon series out of this?
Yeah.
Yes.
And in a different kind of tradition, it may be introducing a thought of a way in which you build on things. And I've preached on, for example, the small catechism, but did not go away for the whole summer. That's kind of a review for Lutherans who last thought about the small catechism when they were getting ready to be confirmed in their teen years, but building it off of the text for ordinary time. So we'll talk about some of those kind of things.
Good
in
stuff.
An interactive kind of way.
Good stuff. April the 30th through May the 2nd. Information will be coming at hintoncenter.org. We're going to give them a week or two to get that information up. You'll be able to make all of your arrangements through Hinton Center. Those of you that have been before, you know what a fabulous place that is. If you haven't joined us for a workshop before, folks, I just got to tell you, it's not because Delmer and I are doing it. It just shows that God can indeed use a couple of fools. But the location is fantastic. The food is good. The fellowship is out of this world. And what God does in our midst as we gather around this word and as we think about ways to get into these texts and let them speak, it's just the best thing I've ever done. So we want you all to come.
All right,
Bubba. Well, we've wrapped it up. Not much left for us to say today other than to tell everybody bye.
Everybody bye.
Lectionary Lab Live is a Two Bubbas and a Bible production. Our opening theme is Lock and Key by Silent Partner. We go out this session with a beautiful song by singer-songwriter Mary Gauthier. Everybody needs a little mercy now.
The fruits of his labor fall and rot slowly on the ground. His work is almost over. It won't be long. He won't be around. I love my father. He could use some mercy now. And my brother could use a little mercy now. He's a stranger to freedom, shackled to his fear and doubts. The pain that he lives in is almost more than living will. I love my brother. He could use some mercy now. My church and my country could use a little mercy now. As they sink into a poison forever to climb out. They carry the weight of the faithful who follow them down. I love my church and country. They could was another mushroom cloud. People in power, they'll do anything to keep their crown. I love life and life itself. Could you some mercy now? Deserve it.